Jesus Asked, episode 15, is the beginning of chapter 7. Jesus pretends. A curious event took place when Jesus visited the non-Jewish region of Tyre and Sidon. A Gentile woman came to him and pleaded with him on behalf of her daughter, whom she was sure Jesus could help. His reaction, though typical and appropriate at the time and in that culture, shocks us. He says no. In Matthew's gospel, Jesus, like his disciples, seems to be of the opinion that she should be sent away. "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel," he says to them, "only to Jews." It's remarkable that Christians should have such a saying of Jesus in their Bibles nowadays, when most Christians are Gentiles. Jesus has said he has not come for them. But does he mean it? Or is he offering the disciples an opportunity to dispute the statement? If he means it, why has he led them into Gentile lands? That's Matthew's gospel. The writer of Luke's gospel, however, tells his tale in such a way to make it clear that Jesus, despite everyone's initial expectations, had not come just for the Jews. His gospel begins like some 1950s Hollywood musical, with the characters constantly breaking into song, or at least psalm. Time after time, to the tune of some orchestra lurking off stage, Mary or Zechariah or other people deliver lyrics about delivering his people from the hands of their enemies. Even when Simeon sings about Gentiles, it's with all the empathy of telling them that God is going to teach them a lesson they'll never forget. "For my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the sight of all people, a light of revelation to the Gentiles, and the glory of your people Israel." Luke 2:30-32. Note, Israel gets the glory. It will be a revelation to everyone else, but they will see it all being prepared. This is a musical with a political message, a message about the people of Israel receiving their Messiah. That's the attitude with which Luke's gospel begins. But then Luke does a curious thing. He does not tell the story of the ministry of Jesus from the beginning, but starts partway in. Other gospels tell us about Jesus' teaching and healing round about Capernaum. Luke just whooshes past that whole period like it didn't happen, and goes directly from the baptism temptation narrative to the sermon in his hometown, Nazareth. Mind you, he knows about Jesus' time in Capernaum. He even has Jesus refer to it in Luke 4:23 within the Nazareth story. But Luke jumps here in order to make the point unambiguously that from the earliest points in his public career, Jesus spoke about ministry not just to Jews, but also to Gentiles. For as part of this episode, Jesus winds up alienating his townspeople by talking about how great prophets like Elijah and Elisha did great things for non-Jews, that their ministry was not only for Israel. In fact, in this sermon, he particularly calls attention to how Elijah helped a Gentile woman and her child in the region of Sidon. This in a sermon near the beginning of Jesus' ministry. Yet Matthew's Jesus, 15 chapters into the book, is still telling his closest followers that he was sent only to people within Israel, that he was not going to help this Gentile woman and her child. And it gets worse before it gets better. When somehow the woman actually does get through to confront Jesus directly, he slings the usual insult for Gentiles like herself, referring to her and people like her as dogs. She's asked for his help. "It's not right," Jesus replies, "to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." Perhaps Jesus' words are the equivalent of a common chess strategy. A pawn offered to your opponent. Its capture leaves you with a disadvantage in terms of material, but gives you a positional advantage that more than compensates. This is a gambit. Setting out a piece unprotected in the very hope that it will be seized. Your intention is to lose it. Jesus played chess. Well, he did with his teaching anyway. Even in Matthew's gospel itself, there are other stories about Jesus helping Gentiles, suggesting that his statements to the disciples and to this Gentile woman do not truly represent his attitude toward non-Jews. It is Matthew, in fact, who tells us about the visit of the three Gentile wise men to Mary and Joseph's baby boy, Matthew 2:1-12. Matthew also tells us of people healed by Jesus in the Gentile region of the Gadarene, 8:28-34, and perhaps best of all, the cure of the servant of the Roman centurion in 8:5-13. In that story, as here, a Gentile asks for help, not for himself, but for someone in his charge. One might have mistaken a Syrophoenician woman for a Jewish one, but it would be hard to mistake the centurion for anything other than a Gentile. And of him, Jesus winds up saying, "I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith." And it is to his own followers that he says this, Matthew 8:10. Did Jesus intend the disciples to remember such incidents when he said to them, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel"? Could it be that he was deliberately saying something that was not quite the truth in order to teach them to contradict it and contradict their own biases? Could Jesus have been playing pawn to Queen's Bishop 4? It's no coincidence that he also winds up using the word great for the faith of this woman, also a Gentile, Matthew 15:28. Non-Jewishness is not the only thing that the woman and the centurion have in common. They are also marked as people who know how to answer Jesus. If Jesus was a man full of questions, one thing that he loved was people who knew how to answer. Back in Matthew 8, the centurion's faith was commended after his famous answer. He said that he was a man well accustomed to authority, giving and taking orders all day long, and he inferred that Jesus' miraculous authority must work along the same lines. Jesus' authority cannot be inferior to his own. The woman gives a similarly clever reply within her encounter with Jesus. And it's all the more remarkable in her situation. How would you have felt? You've heard about this man. Would you approach him? Is he your last hope? His followers, it's clear, want you to be sent away. But you battle on and manage to make it through to present your request, contritely, on bended knee, to the man of wonders, to the man you hope will have compassion. But, disappointingly, he seems like all the rest. He, too, is dismissive and even implies that you're a dog. And to help you would be like wasting food. It's not right, he says to you. Will you argue with him? See, the God of the Jews and the Christians is unlike any other God. Dispute with Jupiter, and you'll have one of those yellow-painted wooden lightning bolts shoved down your throat. Talking back to Allah is likely to get you into even more trouble than talking back to my sixth-grade teacher, Mr. Davidovich. Try arguing with Buddha, and he'll laugh at you derisively for treating any conversation as if it referred to something real. But when you start arguing with Yahweh, he smiles, rolls up his anthropomorphic sleeves, and starts to look interested. And the strangest thing is that he likes losing the arguments even more than he likes winning them. Jacob, the trickster, is beloved of God, and Abraham didn't just get away with asking, "What about if there are only 20 righteous men in the city?" The God of the Jews and Christians is the only God that allows his followers to hear him say, "Oh, all right, you win." The Jewish rabbis remember this even if the Christians forget. One of the best stories in the rabbinic literature concerns a great argument between some of the most illustrious rabbis in history who could not agree with each other. Back and forth they went, each of the four or five sides in the dispute citing scripture snippets to refute whatever had just been proposed. One of the rabbis, Eleazar, appealed to God to intervene in the dispute. And indeed, the Lord spoke from heaven, saying loud and clear, and presumably in a Brooklyn Jewish accent, "Why are you fighting with Rabbi Eleazar? He is utterly and completely right." But this did not settle the argument as far as any other rabbis were concerned. One of them quickly cited Deuteronomy 30:12, "It is not in heaven." And he interpreted it thus, The law has been given once for all at Mount Sinai. We do not listen to voices from heaven. And so it was that Rabbi Eleazar lost the argument, despite having God on his side. Later, the story goes, one of the rabbis met Elijah and asked him how God felt about the whole business. And Elijah related that God was laughing and shaking his head, saying, "My children have defeated me. My children have defeated me." And therein lies the key. Like any parent, God loves playing alongside his children. And like any parent, he loves it best of all when the little ones manage to do something to surprise him and win. And so with the Syrophoenician woman. She argues. She replies to Jesus' gambit, not accepting it as his final word. Jesus was more of a coach than a tutor. He was a motivator. And from all the evidence we have, he was superb at gauging where people were at, what they were thinking, and what they were capable of. And he used this knowledge not to make them all feel comfortable, but to prod and stretch them. Not everybody agrees with this interpretation of Jesus' motives, and his motives are not always easy to discern. It's true that throughout the New Testament, the principle of to the Jew first and then to the Gentile is an important one. See Paul's mission practice throughout Acts 13 to 20. But I find it difficult to believe that Jesus really intended to be rude to this woman and exclude her. If he held back, perhaps it was because he hoped that she would push. And he knew that effort on her part would force her to take him more seriously. So how does she reply? She says, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs may eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table." A female talking back to a male, a Gentile to a Jew. How his rejoinder then, and the smile that will have accompanied it, must have dissolved the tense atmosphere in that interchange. He commends her. "Woman, you have great faith." You have great faith. Not very many people heard that from Jesus' lips. That very hour, her request was granted. Great faith, not little. She's no dog. Or at least she didn't roll over and play dead. When Jesus was rude to the religious big wheels, was he trying to provoke just such a response? Did he expect great things from them? When he told the disciples he was only going to Israel, did he expect them to know better? In the very next chapter of the Gospel, Jesus tells his followers that he's bringing this generation no great sign, except the sign of Jonah. We chiefly remember Jonah for the 3 days in the great fish bit. But to the Jews, the book of Jonah is more than that. It's an object lesson. Its message is that you must not refuse to go to the Gentiles. We're told in the story of the Syrophoenician woman that the people Jesus then encountered praised the God of Israel, Matthew 15:31. The fact that it doesn't simply say praised God is probably meant to imply that these were non-Jews praising a deity who had previously not been their God. Jesus provoked the disciples and this woman, even if not as playfully as when he pretended to the disciples on the Emmaus Road. The story which we'll deal with next time. You've been listening to one of my books called Jesus Asked. My publisher, Zondervan, gave me permission to read you the whole book in weekly episodes. To subscribe or get other episodes, just fire up iTunes Music Store and search for GEMPF, G-E-M-P-F, and then click on the picture. You can also get the MP3s from my website. Just do a web search with the words GEMPF and podcast. The book itself is available from Amazon. The synthesizer background music is by William Fields at teamtechno.com and was used through the Creative Commons licensing scheme. The acoustic surf guitar music is used with the permission of Paul Johnson of the Duotones. Visit him at pjmoto.com. Thanks for listening.